Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. 'Cause there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, live low. 'Cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. You can do what you want. The opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true. And you can make it undo. You see, it's easy. You only need to know.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel on the Weekend. I'm Rick Bruff, and with my co-host Stacy Domalski, and we have a team from the movie HAL, which is not about the computer in 2001.
No.
HAL is, and for film buffs, this is one that, you know, I'm looking forward to. Director Amy Scott and one of the producers, Christine Beebe, and another producer, Brian...
Morrow.
Okay, and we're talking about... to the general public, maybe his films are better known than he is, but like Harold and Maude there, for instance, or Being There, or Shampoo, and talking about Hal Ashby. And Amy, tell us a little bit about what why you wanted to tell this story.
Hal is a seminal filmmaker of the 70s, and the more I started to appreciate his films and research him, I noticed that there wasn't a film about him, and we didn't know sort of what his trajectory was. He was just an inspirational filmmaker, and so we wanted to know more about him.
And what, tell us a little bit about what did you discover things about Hal Ashby in making the film that maybe you didn't know going in?
Oh, sure, lots of things. We examined his films, and then when we started to uncover a lot of research, we found a lot of audio recordings of Hal. And so that's when we really started to unpack who he was. And he was obsessed with filmmaking. He was obsessed with the craft of filmmaking. He was an Academy Award-winning editor before he was ever a director. Mm-hmm. And so we would run onto these really amazing phrases about his ethos about the craft of filmmaking, which was essentially stay obsessed, be dedicated to your craft. And I just didn't realize to the extent of which his work ethic completely defined who he was.
So how did you get access to a lot of these things that you know, maybe the general public didn't have access to, or you didn't maybe at the time didn't even know that they existed? You know, how did you find what you needed?
We partnered with the Hal Ashby Estate, and that was sort of the first. They literally gave us the key to the castle, to his storage space out in the valley in Los Angeles. And the three of us, my two producers, we rolled out there with some cameras and a U-Haul, and we just started pulling things out, and it was incredible. There was a lot of ephemera that we found. You guys can speak to this too.
Also, when you start researching, it's actually a lot of stuff is there, you know, like at the Academy and stuff, that you just have to look for it. So us, along with another producer, Lisa Jansen, we just started looking, and then you find the tapes. You know, everyone asks, like, but what about Hal? You're going to make a movie about Hal. Do you have anything about Hal? And when we first started, we had nothing. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon it's like, oh, we have hours and hours of his own voice talking about his own craft. Mm-hmm.
So I'm a filmmaker too, but the thing I do the most is produce. So I'm a producer, and that is a fancy word for the jobs that no one else wants to do when you're on one of the, especially a research project. So like, what is the strangest place you found something of value? You know, you mentioned that you got to go to his estate. I mean, did he like keep tapes in a horse shed or something?
So, I mean, I think the shed was the storage space was nuts. There was all those sort of projectable things like posters and, you know, artwork. But there was like, for example, there was a giant file cabinet full of, we opened it and it was full of Beta tapes, and the tapes were labeled with the commercials that Chauncey Gardner watched in being there.
Oh.
So he kept all of that. Like, that's one example. I mean, and they were, like, hyper-organized, you know, covered in dust. But or, like, bags of clothes from coming home that Jane Fonda wore. They were still tags and labels on them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
he stole the wardrobe.
Essentially,
yeah. Yeah. So I love Harold and Maude. That's one. And so one of the litmus tests of like whoever I dated, it came out when I was in college, and this guy asked me out, and he said, "Oh, let's see this movie. I know nothing about it." I loved it. I was mesmerized. I come out, and he goes, "Well, that was the worst." And I looked at him, and I went, "I can't date you anymore." So who are the people that you found around Howl that defined more who he was that we may not have known?
Well, I think we didn't realize how important Norman Jewison was, what an influence that Norman Jewison was. And Brian and I were talking about when we sat down and interviewed Norman, it was really profound experience. All the interviews were, it was just kind of ridiculous that we had that kind of access to these Hollywood legends. So we were always trying to be very mindful of the experience, not just in relation to what they said about Hal Ashby, but just filmmaking in general. And so sitting with Norman was really intense.
What was their relationship?
There was a mentor relationship. Okay. And Norman sort of, we learned that he sort of instilled this value in Hal really early on to not compromise your vision, not compromise your artistic vision. And Hal really lived by that, mm-hmm. By that mantra. And I don't know if it ultimately served him well in the end, but it was his ethos, and it was incredible.
So, Brian, how did you guys get involved with this? This was obviously Amy's vision, and then, boom, there you are.
Yeah, Amy was working at my company as on a job as an editor, which is
I was editing cat food commercials.
Yeah, Amy was editing some cat food commercials at my company, and she's also mega pregnant, which is I think the technical term for like 9 months pregnant. Yeah, and I hear from the edit bay some sort of shouting, and I went into panic mode thinking I was going to need to. I ran back there and said, "Do we need to go to the hospital?" And you go, "What? No, oh no, I'm not in labor. I just got the official word from the estate that I'm going to be able to make my documentary." And said, "Oh, really? What's it about?" And she sort of pitched me on the idea. And I was like, right from the get-go, I'm like, wow, that's going to be a really big deal. Like, you're going to the path that's going to go down is to all these Hollywood greats, and I bet they'd be interested in doing this, which is how it went down. So
you jumped on board right away.
But I didn't have a crew. But I knew how they worked. Brian's company is, they make really, really creative films. And so I had seen the footage since I was editing it. And I knew that we could pull it off with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fairly recently I was reading Peter Biskind's book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, which is a great gossipy book about all the young Turks and boy wonders of the 70s. And there's kind of a pattern that emerges is that that for quite a few of them, there is at some point in the career, there's a stumble. And in a couple of cases, the filmmakers recover and they go on to have careers, and others they don't, and they never get back on track. And what happened in that particular case with Hal Ashby? It was like as when the 80s came about, there's you looked at his IMDb list for the 80s, and it was like he lost his mojo somehow, or I don't know if it was him or the industry, the way they treated him, or what happened there, do you think?
I think that the thing was, I don't think that Hal exactly lost his mojo. I think that he was still a really great artist. I think that the industry changed to the extent in the 80s where and I'll say you should definitely come see the film to find out more about it.
That's a good way to put it.
the studios became corporate, and there was quite a lot less room for somebody who was like an uncompromising, rebellious artist like Hal Ashby was in that environment. And so he didn't thrive in the same way that he did in the 70s, where he was afforded some more room creatively to do what he really wanted to do.
I think in the 70s, they were looking for new and creative voices. And in the 80s, it was franchises, Back to the Future. Yeah. And it was, you're right, it was much more corporate. So does the movie go into that phase then of his life as well?
We do. Yeah, the sort of post being there, there's a complete descent. And so that's is part of the reason why we made the film. We wanted to know
what happened to this guy.
Yeah. So I'm not going
to
give that away.
No,
completely.
I don't. I don't want you to. But yeah. It is nice to know that it's addressed.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And I think in a way, in a bigger sense, besides it just being a biopic of going through chronologically, this is what he was like in the 70s, this is what he was like in the 80s. In a way, Hal Ashby represents that film movement of the 70s, which is just such a great, for American cinema, it was such a unique time that all those directors working in that way afforded those the ability to make those choices and explore the characters that they were exploring without the studios breathing down their neck so hard. And in that way, Hal Ashby, if he is a personification of that movement was also kind of killed by that corporatization of the studios.
Mm-hmm. He's in the right place at the right time for what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. It's funny because a lot of those movies, if you do the Hollywood logline or the pitch, nobody is gonna, if you pitch Harold and Maude, it's like, that sounds a little creepy. No. And he, they, go ahead.
Well, they, and to that end, they also, every one of his films, they botched the marketing campaign because how do you market a 20-year-old boy falls in love with an 80-year-old woman? What do we do?
Hilarity ensues.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. It's like, what's the campaign on that?
Pretty great lines from Judd Apatow, mm-hmm, about Harold and Maude and the marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. And how he just can relate to how ridiculous it must have been to try to convince them, or how panicked they must have been in the marketing that they didn't even put an image at all on the poster. Mm-hmm. The poster is just the words.
We don't know what to do with this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they did, and that's part of the, as another brick in the wall of what happened to him. Like they botched the marketing and the landlord. They buried Harold and Maude. That was a cult classic later, but not for him at the time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those films just really didn't have. They're classics now, but at every step, he did fight with the powers that be.
At least he got them made.
He did.
Yeah. And it's an interesting question. How do you summarize his career? You can't say, John Ford did Westerns or Steven Spielberg does, mm-hmm, blockbusters, but what's the commonality of being there, Bound for Glory and Shampoo?
I think he just had his finger on the pulse, and he had really pristine taste, and he knew a good script when he saw it. I wouldn't say he's not an auteur, sort of, you have your genre of films, and you're right, he didn't have that. Bound for Glory is nothing like Shampoo, mm-hmm, and Being There. It's not like The Landlord, but when he had tons of scripts that he constantly workshop, but he knew where the right films were.
Another a thread that kind of came up in doing the interviews, because we did like over 30 interviews for the film, and one of the common things that people said about his filmmaking process as well as the content was that all the stories are very human. And even when you're dealing with kind of almost characters that could easily be caricatures, that he had a way of humanizing them at that level where they became like real roles.
And that would attribute to his direction to those actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you're, for movie buffs, your first chance to see Hal is tomorrow 11:30 at the Mark, and returns Tuesday at the Prospector 8:30 p.m. Again Thursday at the Mark, again in the morning. little trip down to, to the Holiday 2 on Friday at 9:15. And then there's one more chance if you drive down to the Salt Lake on next Saturday at the Broadway Sets. So the production team from the movie Hal, thank you very much for coming
by. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Support for the Sundance Reel on KPCW comes from the film Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, premiering during the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, a documentary about Sandra Lee's journey through breast cancer from diagnosis to recovery and encouraging early detection for all women.
Hi, this is Nancy Ernie of the Ski Resort Property Group, proud sponsor of KPCW. Ski Resort Property Group, in business since 1993, is part of the Berkshire Hathaway Home Services family. Park City has been through 3 real estate cycles in the past 23 years. Let our experience guide you through the next real estate cycle. More about our group at skiresortproperty.com.
We're back with the Sundance Reel on the weekend. I'm Rick Bruff, and my co-host is Stacy Domalski. And from the kids program, we have the documentary Science Fair, and
co-directors, right?
Co-director mm-hmm. Christina yes. Costantini and Darren Foster, And Darren, don't take it the wrong way, but you do look kind of like one of those science teachers I had in junior high. So,
well, we have a premiere today, so I figured I'd look the part a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. with my tweed jacket here.
Yeah. Well, the setting for this is this like the World Olympics of science fairs? Or tell us about this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So for these kids, this is the biggest deal in the world. It's their Olympics. It's their Nobel Prize. It's a huge, huge deal. And I was a science fair kid back in the day, and I competed in the International Science Fair. And it was mind-blowing and life-changing. And so I wanted to make a documentary to commemorate the science fair and the experience we had. So we followed 9 kids from around the world on their quest to win the International Science Fair. And, they're teenagers, so it's a lot of fun, too.
What is the age range in the kids that participate in this?
Yeah, these are high school kids, so teenagers, 14 to 18 years old. So they're really in this formative age, this formative time of their life. So, aside from the science that they're doing, which is top-level research, graduate-level research, there is also the amazing teenage drama that unfolds, and it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of drama and suspense as well. So.
Well, but before we get to the drama and suspense, what give us an example of some of the science fair projects that that you encountered throughout this journey that are like, in your mind, you thought, oh my gosh, how did they come up with that? Or
I mean, they're amazing. Some of them are doing research on cancer, and some of them, one of our students made a test, a very inexpensive test for arsenic in drinking water that could be used in third world settings. One of our kids totally re-engineered an airplane design from the 1920s, and now, NASA is interested in it. So these are, it's not fake scientists, fake science, it's real science, and their minds are so brilliant and inspiring. Yeah.
Yeah, something like 500, more than 500 patents came out of this one science fair alone this year. So
oh my gosh.
It's really top-level stuff that these kids are doing.
And where was this held?
It was held in Los Angeles this year, but it changes cities. It changes between Phoenix, Pittsburgh, and Los Angeles, so the main 3 cities.
And then how many kids are in the final International Science Fair?
So 1,700 kids from 78 different countries.
So it's really an international event. And when you get there, it looks visually so stunning. A lot of the kids wear their traditional attire for the first few days. And so it's like nothing you've ever seen before.
Mm-hmm.
1,700 of the nerdiest kids from around the world.
All right, let's get to the teenage angst. So... were there boyfriend-girlfriend issues? Were there tantrums with mom and dad? I mean, what kind of... At the end of the day, these are still kids.
That's yeah. So one of the things I remember as a student was... every year at the science fair, there's a science fair dance, which is you can imagine, it's a very interesting setting because you have all these brilliant kids, but then you put them in a very teenage setting.
And they're wallflowers.
Exactly. And so
that's what happens when the wallflowers get on the dance floor. It's amazing.
Yeah, so everybody looks forward to the dance. People have crushes. People, they're meeting. They're away from home for the first time, so mm-hmm. it's a lot of fun. The event, and that's definitely where crushes flourish mm-hmm. at the science fair.
Mm-hmm.
Christina, do you remember any in particular one of your science fair projects?
Yeah, so I was in the behavioral science category, and I did an experiment about peer pressure and conformity, and. It turns out I'm just interested in people, and I didn't become a scientist. I became a filmmaker. But I think those experiences that I had taught me so much. They taught me, presentation skills. They taught me confidence. They validated my passion for science and learning. And I think the whole event really set my life on a different trajectory. So we wanted to show other kids going through that same experience.
Nice. And Darren, how were you? Were you a science kid or an English nerd or some other category?
I think I look like an English nerd today, but no, I definitely was a science kid, but not at the level that Christina was. I was more in the sort of exploding volcanoes, potato gun.
the ones like fair. The rest of us. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. So I wasn't getting any patents for the work I was doing.
You weren't curing cancer.
Definitely not.
So tell us a little bit about the experience of co-direction. I saw an interview once with the Coen brothers, and they said,
We're just like that.
Just like that.
And they said, we always say one directed and one produced, and they switch it back and forth, but they said basically we both do everything. So how did you guys meet and decide to do this project together as co-directors?
Well, this is a bit of a change of pace for us. We normally, we're investigative journalists by trade. And so over the last combined decade, we've been doing a lot of investigative documentaries for TV. And Christina and I actually met doing a documentary on fentanyl, which is most famous for killing the pop star Prince. But we did this a couple months before Prince had passed from the overdose. And we met on that project, and we worked really well together. And right after that, Christina told me about this idea she had for doing the science fair. And it is, it's very much like we're such a small team as myself and Christina and during production and then Pete Alton, our director of photography. So,
and Jeffrey Plunkett, our
Jeffrey,
producer.
It was like everybody was doing everything. But Christina and I shared responsibilities on everything. And we complement each other. In both the best and the worst ways.
So in co-direction, though, if you come to a point where you don't agree, who wins?
Christina.
Oh, you said that so quickly, too. I guess you got to have somebody gets a final word there. I'm sure you figure out a way to get what you want in there, too.
I have a little bit more experience than Christina, so there's some like Jedi tricks I know.
Darren is like a very Peabody Award-winning journalist with like years of amazing documentaries under his belt. So sometimes I have to give in.
Well,
he's
then
brilliant.
How did you pick? How did you decide on which kids to pick then? I mean, together, how did you decide that?
We really wanted to show a diverse range of kids. So we wanted to show kids from some of the best schools in the whole world who have terrific science fair programs and resources and funding. And then we wanted to show kids who are, out there doing it by themselves. We wanted to show, what our nation looks like. So, immigrants, people of color. There's a really wide range of of students that we chose. But we wanted to show that diversity that is reflected in the science fair.
So did you ever get a kid where you would ask like this really, you know, intense question and that you would get this? Yes. So, I mean, how did you, as directors, even though this is a documentary, there must have been some direction that you had to do because these are kids.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. You know, the great thing about Science Fair kids is that they have to present all the time. So they're fairly comfortable mm-hmm. talking about their projects. The harder part was getting them to, you know, open up about themselves a little bit. But, you know, that is just about gaining some trust. And over time, we definitely, you know, gained their trust and they became comfortable with us and were more open in expressing themselves. But, you know, basically our approach to the whole thing was to sort of try to be a fly on the wall as much as possible and just let them be themselves and just try to capture that. Obviously, Christina's experience going through this informed a lot of how we approach things, and she knew the moments of drama that would come going through the process of qualifying for ISEF and then going to ISEF. So we just try to be present for those moments.
Without naming names, did you encounter any nightmare parents?
That is definitely like a science fair archetype.
Like the cheerleader mom kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Parents are very heavily involved in the science fair. So you do run into that. I don't think any are featured in our documentary, but but that is definitely
a
thing
there's
you see.
This, my son is brilliant. You know, that kind of thing, and they want to go on and on about Junior.
Yeah,
definitely. One of our characters describes it. She's a 14-year-old girl named Anjali who goes to DuPont Manual. High school in Louisville, Kentucky, and she says, she describes it as crabs in a bucket, basically. Everyone's trying to get to the top, and they keep on pulling each other down. So at some schools, it's very, you know, competitive, especially to get a spot for ISEF. It's very competitive. But as far as parents, I mean, the kids that we're featuring are very self-motivated and very ambitious and very driven in this, and you have to be in order to compete at ISEF. You know, parental involvement, I think a lot of these kids have surpassed their parents in their understanding of the subject matter that they're, you know, studying or researching. So parental advisement is probably go to bed and close your books. You know?
Eat.
Yeah. Now, do you feel, have you discovered, is there any similarity between a youngster competing with 1,700 students in a science fair and two filmmakers competing to get noticed at Sundance, and the crab at the bottom of Robert Redford's bucket.
Yes, actually, when we found out we got into Sundance, I wrote to all the kids and I said, I'm not sure if you've heard of Sundance, but it's basically the ISEF for filmmakers, and that's how we've been explaining it to the kids, which is true.
How many of them are here with you? Or any?
Yeah, there are going to be four students who are at the premiere today and one magnificent teacher.
Mm-hmm. We can't wait for them to see the film. They haven't seen the film yet because we wanted them to have the experience that we had on Tuesday night at the volunteer screening, which is to see it for the first time in front of an audience. And I have to say,
that's the first time you saw your film in front of an audience?
That was the first time we saw our film in front of the audience is when we played it for the volunteers on Tuesday. And it was the most magical experience I think we've ever had. Mm-hmm. The volunteers are just incredible here at Sundance. So big shout out to the volunteers of Sundance.
Yeah. I agree.
And let's say, your first, I think you had a showing in Salt Lake. And your next is today, 12:30, over at the Redstone One. And then Tuesday, you return Tuesday morning at Prospector. And then one more showing at Redstone One at next Saturday, 12:30. So for the film Science Fair, thank you very much, Christina and Darren.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for coming.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson from Davidson Orthopedics, proud sponsor of KPCW. We're pleased to announce the opening of our New Park City office in New Park at 1122 Center Drive, right behind Jupiter Bowl. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Support for KPCW comes from the Crandall family, owners of the New Park Amphitheater, site of the New Park Concert Series, and numerous other community events.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel in the Morning with my co-host Stacy Domalski. One of my guests, Rupert Everett, is just raring to go. I could tell.
This is awake at 6 o'clock this morning, breathless, but very wide awake.
Oh, okay. And for the film The Happy Prince, and quite a few people here wearing different. Most of you are hyphenates. Rupert, you're the star, actor, director, writer.
Producer.
Mm-hmm. And producer. And then we have Colin Morgan, who is also an actor in the film and producer.
No, just the actor. Okay.
Oh, just the
actor. Yeah. Just the actor. Just an actor. Edwin Thomas, are you an actor in this?
I am an actor in this as well. Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, no producing titles. Or
okay. Well, except for.
Well, to start off with, this is a film about Oscar Wilde, and tell us what. You know, it seems sometimes like this is an area that has been covered very often, or, you know, a lot of us just have a superficial idea of who he was. He's the guy in the Monty Python sketch, just trying to compete with Bernard Shaw to come up with epigrams. Rupert, what attracted you to this story?
I think, first of all, there's three films before ours about Oscar Wilde, and each of them are really fantastic in their own way. An actor called Robert Morley played Oscar Wilde, then Peter Finch mm-hmm. played Wilde, and then Stephen Fry played Wilde. And I felt there was room for another one and a slightly different interpretation of the Wilde myth, you know, because Wilde became so famous after he died, and his image was slightly... became slightly sanitized, and my picture of him has always been basically of him when he was in exile after he'd been to prison, and I thought it would be great to do a film that took up where the other films actually ended, because all the other three films go to him being in prison and then they end. And for me, the most exciting part of his life really is his life in exile in the last 3 years of the 19th century. And I think in that time, he provides us in the 20th century, in the 21st century, with one of the most enduring images, really, of change. Because with Oscar Wilde and the Oscar Wilde scandal and his death came the beginning of gay liberation. And what is known now as the LGBTQ movement really started with Oscar Wilde and Oscar Wilde in exile. And so for that reason, I think it's a very interesting story to tell now.
So what did you, there's a lot written about him, a lot, like you said, a lot of it is the history, a lot of it is myth. How did you decide on what it is that you wanted to include? And did you find anything new in any research that you did that you went, wow, that's something I didn't know, and that's something that needs to be brought to light?
Well, the thing I love about him is, for me, he's a kind of Christ figure. And the notion of Christ as part man, part God, is such a fascinating one that we don't really ever explore in the actual idea of Christ. But the idea of it really is that you could be partly an idiot and partly a genius. And Wilde is very much those two things. He's a complete genius, incredibly brilliant, but also a total idiot.
Made some bad choices.
Made some very, very bad choices. And this is what makes you a God, I think, in a way. And it makes you incredibly human and attractive and touching. And so rather than him being, you know, ponderous and solemn and worried and in the same way that Peter Finch or Stephen Fry's productions portrayed him as, I wanted him to be more of this kind of vagrantish, vagabond, Irish tinker character.
Mm-hmm. So given that, what roles do you, lovely gentlemen, play in all of this?
Well, I play Bosie, who is more or less Oscar's main love interest in his life, and again, like Rupert's saying, there's something about that, the way in which Rupert's written this, that is the vagabond, that is the kind of a grimier, dirtier version of, I guess, of this than we've seen before, that drew me to it in the first place. This kind of emotional, visceral version of the story, and to be involved in that, and to see that Bosie was attracted to him in that kind of way, in that kind of fatherly kind of way, in that exciting way, in that scary way, I suppose, was all the things that drew me to it.
Mm-hmm. And in real life, was Bosie in contact with Wilde during his last days?
The last days were tricky, weren't they? Because Bosie wasn't around at that stage, and their last interaction as portrayed in the film wasn't of the most amicable kind. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the best end to the relationship, and I personally think Bosie probably was left with a lot of regrets, and he actually lived out the remainder of his life in a very kind of overcompensatory way, I think, for what he went through due to his experiences with Oscar.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about you?
Yeah.
Well, I play Oscar's other main love interest in his life.
I'll be the judge of that.
and not many people know about Robbie, so I have to stick up for him. I play Robbie Ross, who I think in a really great book called The Secret Life of Oscar Wilde by Neil McKenna, I think he's described, their relationship is described as a deep abiding friendship punctuated by sex, which is... I think it's quite appropriate. I'm a loyal, devoted friend of Oscar's. I end up being his literary executor and devote the rest of my life after Oscar's death to publishing and finding the rights to his work. Not many people know about him. He's a wonderful character, incredibly loyal and always there. But we also had an amorous relationship at various points in Oscar's life. So. Mm.
Yeah, I think one of the things, I mean, certainly for writing this story that interested me is that, for example, in all these great literary characters, you think about the great love affair between Oscar Wilde and Lord Alfred Douglas, mm-hmm. Bosie. But when you kind of start scratching beneath the surface, you wonder whether that was really a love affair, and actually the other love affair that he had, which he really used Robbie Ross quite ruthlessly. But in the end... that was love, because this man, Robbie Ross, looks after Oscar Wilde until he dies. In fact, by the end, Oscar Wilde wants Robbie Ross to be with him. So my idea really is questioning what is a great love story. And I think in the end, what happens between me and Bosie is that it's a story of snobbery, in one sense, from my point of view, because Oscar Wilde is an Irishman, and I hope I'm not speaking out of place here, but
go for it.
In the 19th century in England, the Irish were really nobodies for the. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the English, the English were at their worst possible place at the end of the 19th century, mm-hmm. and the Irish were the top of their list of people they just didn't even count as anything. So. Mm. When Wilde came to England, he changed everything about himself straight away. He stopped speaking with an Irish accent. He became more English than the English. Then he met this lord, which is like meeting a household god, really. You're suddenly in with royalty, more or less. And this went completely to Oscar Wilde's head. And I think Bosie, in a way, understood this and used it. Whereas Robbie Ross was a proper real relationship of someone who loved unconditionally somebody else. Mm. And so part of my story is about the play between those two relationships.
So how many years post-incarceration, he gets out and he bums around and then gets sick and
dies.
It was only 3 years post. So I know there's not a lot written about him during that time, because he kind of fell off the radar. So how did you How did you go about finding the pieces that you need to finish the puzzle?
Well, there, it's pretty well documented. I mean, he was a great letter writer. Everybody was a great letter writer in those days. So you more or less know what he was doing actually every day of those 3 years if you want to. The great biography is by Richard Ellman, and Richard Ellman was getting ill by the time he got to the last bit, so it was a bit sketchy, his biography. But McKenna writes extensively about exile, and also there's lots of writers at the time. Sherrard, one of his friends, Frank Harris, tons of people wrote books at the time about his exile. So it's fairly easy to find out about.
Anything unbelievable that you found out that nobody really knew?
The whole thing is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. The English's behavior towards Wilde was unbelievable, because they'd see him in a bar and just go and spit at him. Mm-hmm. Oh. Or they'd go and say to a waiter, get rid of this lump of shit in this bar. He shouldn't be here. Sorry, I'm not allowed to say that word.
Yeah. Under the new Trump under the new Trump standards, I'm not sure.
But anyway, those are the things that are really extraordinary, because you know, we live in such a comfortable world in many ways, particularly for gay people today, that it's unimaginable for me as a gay man now to think that someone could say to a waiter, get that man out of here, he's trash, and that the waiter would do it, and that happened all the time, and there were endless stories like that.
Yep. Hey, thank you very much, Rupert Everett, and the star of Happy Prince, and the actors Colin Morgan and Edwin Thomas. And you've got your first, I believe, your first showing premiere at the Eccles tonight. You'll be returning Monday to the Park City Library, and next Saturday at the Redstone 2, and next Sunday afternoon at the Grand in Salt Lake City. Thank you, gentlemen, for. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for getting up early on a Sunday and coming in.
A pleasure.
Welcome back again to Sundance Reel in the morning. I'm Rick Bruff, and with Stacy Domalski, and to wrap up for the show this morning, we have a documentary called King in the Wilderness, and this deals with, well, let's have the director Peter Kuhnhart tell us what this looks at and what brought you to this project.
Right. This is the story that most people don't know about Martin Luther King. It's the story of what happened in the last 3 years of his life after he had been kind of solidified in the consciousness as the hero of civil rights in the South. He broadened his work and moved north and began fighting not just for civil rights, but for poverty, for against the war in Vietnam. And he became a very unpopular figure. And it's the story of a man who isn't the leader, the iconic leader that we read about in the textbooks, but a real human being, and how hard that was for him to push forward and accomplish what he needed to accomplish in a world that was increasingly turning against him.
So one of the things that I think people, especially younger people who weren't around when Martin Luther King was around, that they struggle with was he promoted and preached activism through peace, you know, nonviolence, and yet the way he ended was extremely violent. So the dichotomy or the irony, actually, of that, does this address some of that? Like you said, go behind the scenes more of what he was doing the last 3 years of his life. Because from just a general perspective, the last 3 years of his life was like, things that only seem to make sense today. Like, I have teenage sons, and they're like, I don't get why somebody would kill this guy. So do you address some of those things that...
Yeah, absolutely. The struggle of the world with nonviolence is a big part of the story. Nonviolence was in vogue in the South. When he brought those techniques to the North and brought his battle to the North to integrate housing, for example, in Chicago, he was pilloried. He felt more resistance from white Northerners in Chicago than he ever did in the South.
Interesting.
And then at the eve of his death, he was at his least popular in his life. Many blacks thought that he was too soft, and because of nonviolence, they saw nonviolence as weakness, and we correct that myth in the documentary. And whites saw him as a radical communist. So he couldn't win on either side. We have a great line from a black preacher in Chicago when he comes to Chicago, and they asked the preacher, what do you say to Dr. King coming to your town to try to integrate housing? And he said, I would tell him to get the hell out. And you can imagine that it really crystallizes how he was viewed then, how different it was the day before he was assassinated compared to the day after.
And Trey Ellis, the executive producer here, it was just mentioned before air that you did a lot of the interviews. And who did you talk to from that period?
Yeah, it's amazing. Taylor Branch, the great historian, mm-hmm. who was another executive producer, he interviewed Andy Young and Harry Belafonte and this great Reverend C.T. Vivian. I interviewed Jesse Jackson, Joan Baez, John Lewis, all these other people, that Diane Nash, people that for me, like, they were superheroes. For a lot of them, because of their age, because it was so long ago, 50 years ago, and they were in middle age at that time, it might be, unfortunately, some of the last long interviews. So it was really important for us, I think, to get them down. And I would sit with them for 2 or 4 hours at a time and look right in their eyes. And that's sort of a big chunk of this interview.
You know, and we've looked at early interviews some of these great civil rights leaders have given. And at that point, for instance, when Eyes on the Prize was produced, they were still kind of in it. They had a different attitude today. They were ready to tell the story as they really wanted to tell the story. They didn't want to hold anything back. They didn't want to have anything die with them. So I think they were more revealing than they have been in the past.
That's a really interesting observation, because you're right. When you're when you're in the middle of the journey, you don't have perspective. But once you've been through it and you look back, it's reflective, and you can see the highs and the lows and the goods and the bads from it. So you're right. Nobody has actually looked at it from that point of view yet until apparently now.
Yeah, and the human king is a big – that was, to me, the most exciting part of the story. And I think also because, people talked a lot about – even from the recent, like the Kennedy tapes that were revealed, about affairs, about other things, that he was a regular person mm-hmm. compared to all the other people, you know, all the other politicians and preachers of that time. So that freed, I think, a lot of our interviewees to tell the truth about him. And that truth was always like, he actually is more heroic in knowing the whole man.
He's human. That he's human.
Human, but also superhuman in a way that he's human, but also, but you can get there from here. If you really fight hard yourself and really keep up the fight, I think he energizes you to do your best as well. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think before this documentary, the kids we talked about, think of them like George Washington and Martin Luther King sort of as like contemporaries almost. You know, they're all just sort of guys out there and the old guys.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I think that happened to King way quicker than it happened to George Washington. We went back in the research for this film and looked at all the news coverage of King from 68 to 2014. And without exception, King became labeled as the I Have a Dream speech giver, mm-hmm. period. And so whatever news story was happening that involved King, it was always using that clip, I Have a Dream. And it just categorized him in such a way and identified him in a way that became boring over time and became wooden over time. So I do think what Trey was saying about learning about the man and learning how learning how much of a workaholic he was. He just couldn't stop. He was on a track of change, and he couldn't stop. So as this film progresses, you see him almost like going down a river, and he can't stop the current. He must follow to the end.
He kind of became a victim of his own success.
He knew where, and besides the famous speech, a mountaintop speech before his on the eve of his death, he would often talk about. He understood that that's how he was going to end. And also, if you think of all the bad press that he got, then nobody was harder on him than himself. And his Andy Young and all of his advisors were trying to, like, really trying to buck him up and say, look, you can't. You know, have the weight of the entire world on your shoulders, and he just couldn't shake it. So there's a sadness to him too that I think that people didn't know.
In that same vein, workaholic and a sadness at bearing the burden. Did you talk to any of his family, any of his surviving family?
We didn't speak to his family. They've been historically very guarded about his reputation and about who he is. So we thought sitting down talking with his friends, I mean, everybody, they're all, you know, in their 80s and some 90s, people that knew him at that moment. I think that was, it was really, it sheds an amazing light on him that I think we'll never get again.
How old would he have been now?
That is a good question.
That's a great question. I, no idea.
The people, I mean, you know, the range of of his contemporaries from Andy Young on is like middle 80s to early 90s.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see what... if he had lived, you know, his perspective on everything that's changed since then and what's going on now. That's
absolutely
why.
Yeah. The film Chin in the Wilderness, I think you've got your first showing coming up at the Mark tomorrow at 5:30, and then you move over to the Temple on Tuesday, and Redstone One on Saturday is your last showing in this area at 6:30 p.m. And a week from today, you have a one down in Salt Lake at the Wagner. So Peter Kuhnhart, the director, and Trey Ellis, the executive producer, thank you very much for wrapping up the Sundance Reel with us. I'm Rick Bruff here with the multi-talented Stacey Domalski, Cecil B. Domalski. Yeah. And running the board for us is Sophia, keeping us all in line. I should mention that we're presented by Sandra Lee Incorporated, presenting the documentary Prescription Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee. Thank you very much for being with us this weekend. We'll see you next year.
Thanks.
Some of the world's up-and-coming filmmakers will be in Park City for the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, and you can find out all about their newest project. Tune in to KPCW each weekday morning between 9 and 10 for the Sundance Reel, and for the first weekend of the festival between 8 and 10 to hear from filmmakers, producers, and film critics. That's the Sundance Reel through January 26th right here on KPCW or online at kpcw.org.
Support for the Sundance Reel comes from the documentary Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, with public screenings during the 2018 Sundance Film Festival.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com,
Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974. FredMarshallPainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Approaching me.